Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. For the sake of the audio record, I will say that today's date is January 17, 2024. This panel of the court today has four cases on its oral argument calendar. I apologize for the cold temperature in the courtroom. We have notified maintenance and asked for it to be turned up, but I think that's about all we can do. If we had a wood-burning stove, I would ask the marshal to light a fire, but we don't. We're not so equipped, so we'll have to proceed without that. I will call the first case for oral argument. It's case number A23-1176 in the matter of the child of MEP and THV. I understand that counsel, I see multiple attorneys at the table, but you're not splitting argument time. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument, and then appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for rebuttal argument. Appellant's counsel, please approach the lectern and begin. You may introduce yourself and your client or clients, and then you may begin.
All right. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Lucas Dawson, and together with Christina Zaher, we represent the appellants in this matter, the parents of Keaton Peck. To hear the words, "you have cancer," are some of the most jarring words that a person can hear. But to hear the words, "your child has cancer," is truly unimaginable. They're some of the worst words that a parent can hear, and it's no dispute that it's a lonely road. No one can truly understand the childhood cancer journey until one experiences it. Unfortunately, that's led to why we are here today. On December 16th of 2022, the appellant's family was altered forever when they learned that their 5-year-old child had cancer. Keaton was diagnosed with T-cell acute lymphoblastic leukemia, referred to, and I'll refer to it in my oral argument, as T-cell ALL. Yet a cloud has been hanging over this diagnosis, and that we are also here because child protection became involved. And so in addition to having the childhood diagnosis of cancer, we also have child protection. Yet by all accounts, appellants are great parents. Yet the state stepped in, removed their child, forced chemotherapy, and stripped them of their decision-making authority. Now, as outlined in the brief, I believe there are three arguments for the court today, and if it's all right, I was planning to take them a little out of order. The first, Your Honors, is that the district court and child protection violated the parents' due process rights by substituting its judgment for that of the parents. Now, as is clearly stated in the brief, parents are presumed fit. When you look at the case law, parents are presumed fit and entrusted with the care of their children. This means it is a presumption that the state has to overcome. With this presumption, the law does not require parents to be doctors or lawyers or anyone with some sort of a professional degree or expertise. In fact, the majority of babies are born and sent home with brand new parents who have no idea what they're doing, and yet they learn. Within this presumption, parents have the right to make important medical decisions for their children, even if the parent, for example, does not even have a high school diploma. The state's argument that the court ultimately adopted was that the individual with the medical degree was the one who knew best and substituted his judgment for that of the parents.
Ms. Dawson, the U.S. Supreme Court in Parham in 1979 said that the presumption exists absent a finding of neglect or abuse. In other words, I mean, it's not, would you agree that the parent's right to care, custody, and control at some point yields to the government's interest in ensuring the health of a child?
I would agree that it is not absolute, but I do believe this case is distinguishable from both Parham as well as, I believe, kind of the main case out there for the state of Minnesota, that's the Lundum v. McCown case.
Which is a tort case, and I think it's not as, you know, it's not helpful. I'm curious whether you're aware of case law from any state that's kind of more similar to this case, where a parent's right to decline treatment for a serious medical condition was upheld by the court because of the parent's right to care, custody, and control, despite a government's, you know, position that that different course or more treatment was required.
And as far as I'm aware, and based on, of course, as thorough research as we can do, there's no specific case on point. And I think going back to your Parham case that you mentioned, Your Honor, would be an acknowledging that the right is not absolute. But if you piecemeal together with what our case law also tells us, what is missing in this case is that we have two parents where, by all accounts, we do not have an active disease. And that's where we get into a distinguishing factor here. By all medical records and all testimony received in trial, is that Keaton's cancer diagnosis was non-detectable. And so we're talking about a maintenance phase of chemo.
But isn't that inconsistent with the testimony that it is going to come back with certainty? And if the protocol is not followed, that his likelihood of survival is basically nil? I mean, that is in the record. So I understand you're saying at this moment, you know, but non-detectable said that in the one sample we got, we couldn't find it, but we know it's going to come back.
Well, and I think I actually would disagree that that's truly what the record says, because okay. Dr. Gasai also testified that the cancer may never come back. So he also testified it is entirely possible, and this was through the cross-exam of the parents, he did testify that the cancer may never come back and that it is possible.
But not likely.
I don't even believe he said
well,
not likely.
Didn't he
likely.
Say 10 to 20% chance of survival?
It's the 10 to 25% chance of survival if the cancer returns. And he also acknowledged the cancer could still return even if the chemotherapy is finished. He also acknowledged that there, quite frankly, are no studies that tell us a parent who, for example, diverts from the current protocol, as he referred to it, and used homeopathic medicine. He also acknowledged the study that he relied on. Parents had the right to choose to participate in the study that developed the protocol, and had the right to choose to discontinue the study. And so that's where this case ultimately does also get into a parent weighing not only that chemotherapy protocol, but the child's quality of life.
So and, can I follow up on Judge Siegel's question to you? The district court found that Dr. Gasai testified that non-detectable status does not mean an individual is cancer-free or that the cancer will not return. And in your brief, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think you challenged that finding of, well, or, and the district court made a similar finding, and I don't think you challenged that finding as clearly erroneous.
No, I would agree based on the medical testimony, not the... The term non-detectable, they don't use this cure rate that I think the layperson would typically understand. They use the terminology non-detectable.
So you would agree, though, that there isn't any evidence that the child is cancer-free?
I would. Well, and I think that question was even asked, Your Honor, during questioning. And the answer was they don't use that terminology. So to say cancer-free would actually be the incorrect terminology, period. It's just simply non-detectable. And non-detectable could also mean the cancer never returns.
You use the term cancer-free at page 26 of your brief. Are you...
And I apologize if I could just...
Are you withdrawing that assertion? It's in the first full...
I see it there, Your Honor. And, Your Honor, I guess I would withdraw that to simply argue the correct medical terminology would be non-detectable. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have one further related question. The district court, in its order, paragraph 22 on page 34, states, parents have not specified a constitutional challenge to support their opposition to chemotherapy treatment. So is this due process argument that you're raising on appeal properly before us, where the district court didn't decide the specific issue that it seems that you're raising before us?
And, Your Honor, I'm glad you actually brought that up, as I do know that the state in its responsive brief argued that point. We did submit a reply brief. And I would refer the court to the parents' original motion to dismiss, which was filed on February 6th, where prior to the conclusion of law, the very last sentence, in fact, the parents argued, here ordering protective services and medical care for the child against the wishes of mother and father would be a direct violation of their constitutional rights as parents. In addition, Your Honor, if you look actually at the court's findings of fact, paragraphs 16, 36, 40, 43, and 47, which summarizes the parents' testimony. It also articulates that the parents frequently testified and clearly articulated that they felt they had the choice to make the medical decisions for their child. That is a constitutional right. And when you weigh that with the Parham case that Judge Johnson brought up, that's where we get into the parents very clearly articulated the constitutional right and clearly articulated the constitutional right to make medical decisions for their child.
Thank you.
And so what we're getting into, as I articulated, is whether this question of an active disease, the secondary component, quite frankly, is whether these are fit parents. And fit parents get to make decisions for their children. After the initial round of treatment, Keaton had no detectable disease. The family cooperated with that initial treatment, and then felt that they wanted to make different decisions for their child. Under the department's theory, then, no parent can dispute the treatment plan for their child when there's cancer, ever. This is a 2.5 years of maintenance. At some point, do they get to say, we feel it's been enough, we feel he's not responding well, we feel he's got these horrible side effects that we need to wait? Keep in mind, during the course of this treatment, Keaton was admitted where the hospital, based on authority from the county, authorized the next phase of treatment. When the parents were concerned that Keaton was ill, they could say nothing.
So couldn't the parents go back into court? I mean, if things are taking a turn much for the worse, and nobody is diminishing the terrible side effects, you know, from treatment like this, but if the medical professionals kind of disagreed and said, no, let's keep going, I mean, it seems at that point that the parents could go back into court again and say, look, the facts have changed. This is what's going on now.
Except that that's what got them into court in the first place, Your Honor, is that respect, with all due respect, they said Keaton in his first round even suffered serious side effects. And they were even saying, we're not saying no chemo ever, but our son needs some time to heal, for his body to heal, instead of jumping right into the next phase of treatment. And they agreed to continue to monitor it. And so to then say they could go back into court.
I'm saying if the facts change, not just kind of the expected side effects, but something dramatic.
Well, but then who's going to measure?
More dramatic. I don't want to diminish the impact.
But then who's going to measure what's more dramatic? And that's where we allow parents in those moments to make those decisions, especially when they're presumed fit. Because in that moment, especially when we're talking about a medical issue for a child, decisions may need to be made in that exact moment. There may not be time to say, hold on a second, while I go to the court. Quite frankly, with all due respect to our legal system, it takes time. It does not happen simply in a matter of an hour or two to make a change of a decision. And so when you look at the fact that we've got two parents who, by all accounts, are great parents, who who were considering Keaton's needs and who were weighing all of his needs, not just a 2.5-year treatment for chemo, who were weighing his quality of life. When you look at the testimony, even the testimony of the guardian ad litem, these are wonderful parents who were finding every possible way to try to help treat their son.
Ms. Dawson, sorry to interrupt, but time is short. So it seems to me, I mean, as I understand the record, even the witnesses who might have been favorable, or I should say, might have leaned toward your client's way of looking at the medical situation, they seem to believe that at most an integrative approach, which, you know, involved both chemotherapy and other forms of homeopathic or other treatments, that was as far as they would go. There's no medical professional, it seems to me, who testified that the absence of chemotherapy and to rely solely on homeopathic treatments is a wise course of action. Am I correct in that? And if so, I mean, if I understand the record correctly, isn't that a real weakness in your position?
Your Honor, I would agree. I believe it was Dr. Donna LaBallon, I always struggled with the name, and Dr. Healy as well, who both also testified that there can be an integrative approach. And when you also look at the parents' testimony, again, they're still not saying no chemo ever, but looking at someone who could really take a more individualized approach to what their child would need, yet by the court stepping in, quite frankly, if you even look at, I apologize if I could just finish the
yes,
answer.
Yes, of course.
At the time of removal, mother had had appointment with a naturopathic doctor. It was with Dr. Healy to look at some alternative forms, consulted with at least one doctor in Texas. We even heard testimony, for example, from Dr. Gasai, that there are other hospitals that use other protocols, not just what Children's Hospital uses. So the parents were, quite frankly, never even allowed to fully explore all of those possibilities because we got into a situation where Keaton was removed. The court gave Child Protection the authority to make all of those decisions. And quite frankly, that limits a parent's ability to take steps after that.
Wait, one more question about the evidentiary record. Am I correct in understanding that Dr. Healy, I think she goes by Dr. Healy, is that she's not an MD? Or a DO, I'm not sure, you know, what is the nature of her education and training and licensing?
Yeah, and she did testify to that she's not allowed to say that she's a medical doctor, but that the state of Minnesota licensing board, because she's considered to be a natural doctor, still goes by the doctor route, but she has this additional training and education, and I think she even testified out, maybe in Minnesota we're not as used to that, but other states are more used to involving the naturopathic doctors.
Does that involve, I mean, is there an education requirement beyond a bachelor's degree for that?
I do believe she had higher education, and I apologize, it's escaping me at this exact moment. I can double check and
higher than bachelor's?
Rebuttal.
I'm sorry, to be clear, you believe it was higher, she had more education than a bachelor's degree?
Yes, I do believe she did.
Okay. Thank you very much. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent, you may approach. Please introduce yourself and your client, and then you may begin your argument.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. Rachel Pence, Assistant Wright County Attorney, appearing on behalf of respondent, Wright County Health and Human Services. Your Honor's appellants will have this court believe that parents' rights to make medical decisions for their child should supersede the medical advice of a highly specialized doctor making life-saving treatment recommendations, even when doing so could be at the expense of the child's life. Appellants attempt to further this assertion in two ways. First, by challenging the district court's conclusions of law, and second, by challenging the constitutionality of the state's intervention in KKP's treatment. This court should review the district court's determination that a statutory basis exists to adjudicate the child as a child in need of protection or services for an abuse of discretion, and it shall perform a de novo review of the alleged due process violation. As to the issue of the CHIPS adjudication, on page 26 of appellant's brief, they say that the district court misapplied the statute's plain language to the facts at trial. So it appears they are couching a statutory interpretation issue inside an evidentiary issue. They also seem to be conflating findings of fact with conclusions of law. They are essentially asking this court to reweigh the evidence, as they have not stated any factual inaccuracy by the district court in the 43 pages of their brief. Rather, they are merely arguing over the court's determination of the evidence, and they are not showing how that is an abuse of discretion. Substantial evidence supports the district court's findings of fact and conclusions of law as it relates to adjudicating KKP as a child in need of protection or services pursuant to Minnesota Statute 260C.007, Subdivision 6, Paren 3, Subdivision 6, Paren 4, Subdivision 6, Paren 5, and Subdivision 6, Paren 9. There is clear and convincing evidence that KKP has T-cell acute lymphoblastic leukemia, or T-cell ALL, a deadly cancer that targets children, that the standard treatment at this point is prolonged chemotherapy, that the survival rate is much higher if he continues treatment right now rather than waiting for the cancer to become detectable again, that the survival rate with the current treatment plan is 93.1%, that prior to recent significant developments to the treatment protocol, the survival rate was 30 to 40%, and that there are no other medically accepted treatments proven to work.
Ms. Penn, opposing counsel said that the 10 to 20% survival rate is triggered if there's a reoccurrence or if it becomes detectable again. First of all, do you agree with that statement? And then secondly, is there evidence about the probability that it would become detectable again?
Your Honor, I believe that that's sort of a two-part question. Dr. Gesaid?
Right, it is a two-part question, and that's that I'm trying to understand it, you know, to in order to fully understand the sort of survival rate without further chemotherapy.
Yeah, absolutely. And Dr. Gesaid did testify that he cannot definitively say that the cancer would come back. He can say that it's likely that it will come back, and that if and when it does come back, that the survival rate is significantly reduced once there's a relapse.
So in the first step, when he said likely, that would might imply more than 50%. Is that the way you read the record? But
Dr. Gesaid specifically said that the relapse rate is high within the first year of diagnosis. I don't have a specific number in the record for how likely it is that there would be a relapse, but that's why I wanted to note for this court that 30 to 40% number, because Dr. Gesaid did provide extensive testimony that over the years they've perfected this treatment, and back in the 70s, they started this five-phase treatment regimen, and back in the 70s, the survival rate of children with KKP's diagnosis was only 30 to 40%. They have since made significant advancements, and that's how we've gotten to this 93.1% survival rate.
Okay, and one more question. How do we reconcile the 30 to 40 with the 10 to 25? How are those two probabilities different? Or was that different? Sources of evidence. I'm not sure.
Your Honor, the court's order says the most recent data indicate the chance of survival is less than 20% if the cancer is to return. And so my understanding is that when they do see somebody coming back in with a relapse of cancer, that's that 20% number. Again, I think that it's really important and relevant, though, to note these advances and that there were significantly reduced survival rates, you know, many years ago.
I have two questions about appellant's reliance on the Constitution. It's sort of a comment, but I'll give you an opportunity to respond. It seems to me that in a court trial, the way in which a party would present an issue such as constitutional rights is—obviously, it was a long trial with a lot of evidence, but it might be in a trial memorandum if trial memos were requested. But I think they weren't in this case, but it seems like the parties did file proposed findings and conclusions of law, and in appellant's proposed findings and conclusions of law, they had extensive proposed conclusions about constitutional law. Isn't that a proper way to preserve the issue of constitutional rights?
Your Honor, I did review the appellate rules of procedure, and it's the respondent's position that the constitutional issue was not properly briefed. Therefore, we do believe that that issue was waived by appellants.
What should they have done in order to preserve it?
Appellant Procedure Rule 128.02, Subdivision 1, Paren B, Paren 1, requires a description of how the issue was raised and a citation to the record. In this case, we don't have any citations to the record.
Well, I've seen that proposed findings that they filed. Let's just look back at what happened in the district court. What must the plaintiffs do in order to preserve that issue? And what more could they have done besides presenting those legal issues to the court and proposed conclusions of law?
Your Honor, we did intend today on addressing that constitutional issue just on its merits, but again, I do believe that the citation to the record in any of their filings with the district court. I would also note that it is not clearly stated in their brief whether they're challenging the constitutionality of the statute, although we are obviously assuming that they're asking or challenging how the statute applies to the court depriving the parents of their substantive due process right to parent KKP as they see fit. And so I would just note that appellants have not provided any single case to support their position that parents' rights to decide medical care for their child is unconditional. And the respondent does not dispute that the parents do have a fundamental right to direct their child's upbringing, including the right to direct the child's medical care. However, as I noted, that right is not absolute. Minnesota has evidenced a clear legislative preference for medical care to be provided for the safety and well-being of children, and that it is a compelling state interest. When a child's life is at stake, the state's paramount duty is to ensure the welfare of the child. We'll just note here that KKP's...
What authority are you relying on? I just want to be clear what legal support you're relying on for that argument. You talked about the legislative preference, and so I'm wondering what particular statutes you're referring to.
Yes, Your Honor. So Troxell v. Granville talks about the right to parent one's child the way the parent sees fit is a protected fundamental right. Lundman v. McCown does state states have a compelling interest in protecting the lives and health of its children. In Ray, welfare of child of RDL, when a child's life is at stake, the state's paramount duty is to ensure the welfare of the child. State statute says that the best interest of the child is paramount and that there's a compelling state interest in ensuring essentially life-saving treatment for children.
Counsel, assuming the issue was properly before the district court, is this an issue that this court should decide, or should the issue be remanded back to the district court to make further findings and then decide the issue? Constitutional issue. In other words, are the district court's findings sufficient in relation to this issue to allow for appellate review? Or should the matter be remanded back to the district court? Not the matter, but should that issue go back to the district court?
And I do believe that the court's order does make very specific findings that would sufficiently address any issue related to the parents' rights to make a decision for their child. Again, the court's order, as appellants noted, covers a lot of findings of fact about the parents' love and care for their children, but essentially noting that that is not an absolute medical decision-making is not an absolute right, and that in this situation, it would have been not in the child's best interest to allow the parents to continue making decisions that were against medical advice of a highly qualified pediatric oncologist.
Did appellant argues that the parents were not allowed to explore other possible options? Can you address that argument?
Yes, Your Honor. So they were certainly given an opportunity to seek input from other medical professionals. Obviously, they did have a chance to work with Dr. Healy. Dr. Gasai did provide testimony during trial that he reached out to Dr. Healy to talk with her about proposals. I would also note that the parents requested a second opinion, and so Dr. Gasai did reach out to a doctor in Texas, a pediatric oncologist that recommended the same course of treatment. I would also note that Dr. Gasai, they started the initial treatment in December of 2022. He met with them. They were supposed to start the second phase of treatment, the consolidation phase, on January 23rd. That's when they relayed to him for the first time that they did have significant concerns. He provided testimony that he met with them the 23rd, 24th, 25th to talk out all of their concerns. And that, unfortunately, he said time is of the essence in this matter. And so a week passed and they still had indicated an unwillingness to proceed with the treatment. And so that's when the report was made to Child Protection. Your Honors, as was discussed during appellant's argument, I just wanted to touch on the issue of the detectable disease, because obviously that seems to be the what the appellant's argument hinges on. The reality is that based on the data, it's almost entirely certain that there will still be microscopic cancer cells in KKP's body at the time of filing of the petition, at the time of trial, and even potentially today. But regardless of the presence or lack thereof of detectable cancer cells, Dr. Gasai deemed prolonged chemotherapy treatment to be medically necessary. As this court noted, there was no credible evidence from any medical professional that it would be a reasonable medical decision for KKP to forego treatment, including from appellant's own witnesses, nor is there evidence of a medically accepted alternative that is proven to be even somewhat efficacious. Dr. Gasai's testimony provided that stopping treatment after the initial round would be insufficient to achieve a cure and would lead to a likely untreatable occurrence and ultimate death. Delaying treatment in this case will cause the survival rate for the disease to decrease each day treatment is delayed. Would note that legislative intent would indicate that imminence does not require tragedy to strike. Given the way cancer works, by the time the risk is visible in the form of detectable leukemia returning, KKP's chance of survival would be substantially diminished.
Ms. Pence, I have a question about the second issue in appellant's brief has to do with the out-of-home placement plan. I'm just wondering whether the plan that existed at the time of the order that's on review is still in place, or whether there's been any subsequent events that might have changed that plan?
The out-of-home placement plan as of today is still as it was written when it was originally court-ordered.
Okay, thank you.
And I would just like to end by saying that consistent with Dr. Gasai's credible expert testimony, the district court properly concluded that KKP's condition remains an emergency until the recommended prolonged treatment is complete. Specifically, Dr. Gasai testified that the emergency to me is the need to remove the risk of leukemia, and that does not end until the completion of all the therapy.
Thank you, Ms. Pence. Thank you for your argument. Ms. Dawson, you have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal argument.
I think picking up right where counsel just left off leads to a concern that I voiced down at the district court level, is we cannot ignore the fact that we are here on a child protection case where there are timelines regarding out-of-home placement There are timelines regarding court involvement, and I don't think it can be ignored, of course, the additional burden of having child protection involved in a family's life. The concern that was raised at the district court and that I still hear today is that, and let me maybe even back up just a moment, the idea of child protection is to, if there is an allegation, to step in, attempt to remedy the situation, and step back out. Child protection is not meant to be a permanent fixture in a family's life. And when you look at those timelines, that becomes problematic because, of course, the longer that a child is in out-of-home placement, the more that the county is actually mandated to then look at permanency for the child. And in the case that we have here, not only was Keaton Peck removed from his family and placed in out-of-home placement, but it began that proverbial clock. The clock was ticking as to when the department would have to look at permanency.
So the county argues on page 25 of its responsive brief, they make an alternative argument, I think, that this court could retroactively remove any days that were counted as out-of-home placement days. I don't think you replied to that in your reply brief. Would that remedy or would that accommodation suggested by the county, would that take care of your concerns?
And I do believe that the reason there was not reply was that in appellant's principal brief, we did argue that he should have never even been placed in out-of-home placement to begin with. So we appealed that very finding itself.
Understood. But this is an alternative argument. Sort of this is an alternative argument by the county about if there is an error with respect to that issue, this is a remedy which could be, could be appropriate. What do you think of that potential remedy?
Your Honor, I would definitely invite that remedy, especially when looking.
I'm sorry, you would?
I would invite that remedy. Especially when looking from the standpoint, when you look at out-of-home placement and the very purpose of it, and one of the issues at the district court level was that out-of-home placement should not be taken lightly. A child should really only be removed when they're, as the statute says, their immediate health, safety, or welfare is immediately endangered and could not be remedied still in the care of the parents. Here we have a situation where the child was placed on a 72-hour hold away from his parents. And then we get into a situation where he was still deemed to be an out-of-home placement even though the parents were in the home. And even though the parents, despite their objections, I'll acknowledge to, of course, the treatment, still brought him and followed all court orders. They were the parents. They were the individuals still bringing him for this treatment. They were the individuals still bringing him and staying with him during all of his hospital stays. And when you look at that, that's not the definition of out-of-home placement. And
it seems to me, I would agree that it's not very often we see out-of-home placement plans where the parent and the child are living in the same home.
Well, and I'd argue legally, you shouldn't. Because legally, out-of-home placement, by federal mandate even, requires placement away from the parents.
But it seems like that feature of the plan was beneficial to your clients. I mean, you obviously wouldn't complain about the fact that your clients, the parents, were allowed to live in the same home with the child, right? That was so. I'm not sure what you're saying should have happened. I mean, should the district court have required the parents to stay away?
It should have been protective supervision. It should have been protective supervision. If you look at the exhibits that were received, if you look at the record, there were the continuous counting of out-of-home placement days. And those days matter. They matter because not only do we look at permanency timelines, that if a trial home visit, which the court ordered at the time of adjudication, still counts as out-of-home placement. Your days still count. So while it's beneficial to my clients in a sort of lofty way, they still have the issue of those out-of-home placement days and the legal effect of those days.
And did you urge the district court to order protective supervision instead of?
Yes, Your Honor. And I prior to the conclusion of trial, a motion was made to correct those days. To correct those days to say this never should have been out-of-home placement. It, first of all, cannot be deemed a trial home visit until there is an adjudication. It also should never have been considered those out-of-home placement days with the parents actually living in the home, because again, it leads to the collateral consequences, and those days still count even going forward. There's even a look back period. So if at any point, I believe it's in the next 2 years, child protection becomes involved, those days still matter. And so when we've got a family, and I apologize if I could just finish my thought.
Yes, you may.
When we've got a family who, again, by all testimony, are wonderful parents, I don't think anyone would have recommended termination, but we've got a clock. We've got this timeline, this firm mandate by both state and federal law that says they have to look at permanency. Those days matter. And so to have them hanging over the parents' head is error. And so while yes, they may have benefited, they still matter and they still are a detriment to the family. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dawson. Thank you to both attorneys or all attorneys for your arguments, both written and oral. They were very helpful to the court in resolving what is obviously a difficult case. Thank you. Case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion in writing within 45 days, I believe, is the statutory requirement in a case of this type.